Dirk! Sean found his voice, as he fought himself out of the coils in which he had been trapped by Dirk. I have known many men, and not one of them was all good nor completely evil. They were all combinations of those two elements, good and evil. That is until I came to know you. You were the only man who was totally evil, evil unrelieved by the slightest shading of good. And when at last I was forced to face that fact, then I turned my back on you. Father, don't call me that. You are not mine, and you never will be again. There is a great fortune, one of the great fortunes of the world. No, Sean shook his head. It is not there for either you or me. It belongs to a people, to many peoples, Zulu and Englishman and Afrikaner, not to me, but especially not to you. When I came to see you last, you gave me cause to believe, Dirk began to protest. I gave you no cause, I made no promise, but I told you everything, all my plans. Yes, said Sean. I wanted to hear it. I wanted to know every detail, not so that I could help you, but so that I could stand in your way. Sean paused for emphasis, and then leaned across, so his face was close to Dirk's, and he could look into his eyes. You will never get the land beyond the Bubezi River. I swear that to you, he said it quietly, but with a force that made every word ring like a cathedral bell. Dirk recoiled, and the high colour drained away from his face. I rejected you because you are evil. I will fight you with all my strength, with my life itself. Dirk's features changed. The line of the mouth and the set of the jaw altered. The slant and tilt of the eyes became wolfish. You deceive yourself, father. You and I are one. If I am evil, then you are the source and fountain and father of that evil. Don't spout noble words to me. Don't strike postures. I know you, remember. I know you perfectly, as I know myself. He laughed again, but not the bright, easy laughter of before. It was a cruel, thin sound, and the shape of the mouth did not lose its hard line. You rejected me for that Jewish whore of yours, and the bastard slut you spawned on her soft white belly. Sean bellowed, a low, dull roar of anger, and the stallion reared under him, coming up high on his hindquarters and cutting at the air, and the bay mare swung away in alarm, milling and trampling, as Dirk sawed at his mouth with its curb. You say you will fight me with your life, Dirk shouted at his father. It may just come to that. I warn you. He brought the horse under control, barging in on the stallion so he could shout again. No man stands in my way. I will destroy you as I have destroyed the others who have tried it. I will destroy you and your Jewish whore. Sean swung backhanded with a shambok, a polo cut, using the wrist so the thin black lash of hippo hide fluted like the wing of a flighting goose. He aimed at the face, at the snarling, vicious wolf's head of the man who once had been his son. Dirk threw up his arm and caught the stroke. It split the woven tweed of his sleeve like a sword cut, and bright blood sprang to stain the luxurious cloth as he kneed the bay away in a wide, prancing circle. He held the wound, pressing the lips of the cut together while he glared at Sean, his face contorted with utter malevolence. I'll kill you for that, he said softly. And then he swung the bay away and put her into a dead gallop, straight at the five-stranded barbed fence. The bay went up and stretched at the jump, flying free of the earth and then landing again on the far side, neatly gathered and fully in hand, reached out again into a run, a superb piece of horsemanship. Sean walked the stallion, fighting the temptation to lash him into a gallop, following the path over the high ground, a path now almost indiscernible, long overgrown. Only a man who knew it well, who had been along it often, would know it as a path. There was nothing left of the huts of M'Bjani's kraal, except the outline of building stones, white circles in the grass. They had burned the huts, of course, as is the Zulu custom when a chief is dead. The wall of the cattle kraal was still intact, the stone carefully and lovingly selected, each piece fitted into the shoulder-high structure. Sean dismounted and tethered the stallion at the gateway. He saw that his hands were still shaking, as though in high fever, and he felt sick to the gut, the aftermath of that wild storm of emotion. He found his seat on the stone wall, the same flat rock that seemed moulded to his buttocks, and he lit a cheroot. The fragrant smoke calmed the flutter of his heart and soothed the trembling in his hands. He looked down at the floor of the kraal. A Zulu chief is buried in the centre of this cattle kraal, sitting upright facing the rising sun, with his Induna's ring still on his head, wrapped in the wet skin of a freshly killed ox, the symbol of his wealth, and with his food pot and his beer pot and his snuff box, his shield and his spears at his side, in readiness for the journey. "Hello, old friend," said Sean softly. "We reared him, you and I. Yet he killed you. I do not know how, nor can I prove it. But I know he killed you. And now he's vowed to kill me also." And his voice quivered. "Well," smiled Sean, "if you have to make an appointment to speak with me, it must be some business of dire consequence." Through the merry twinkle of his eye, he was examining Mark with a shrewd, assessing gaze. Storm had been right, of course. The lad had been gathering himself to make the break. To go off somewhere on his own, like a wounded animal, perhaps, or a cub lion leaving the pride at full growth. Which was it, Sean wondered, and how great a wrench would the parting make on the youngster? "Yes, sir, you could say that," Mark agreed, but he could not meet Sean's eyes for once. The usually bright and candid eyes slid past Sean's and went to the books on the shelves, went on to the windows and the sweeping sunlit view across the tops of the plantations and the valley below. He examined it as though he had never seen it before. "Oh, come on, then." Sean swiveled his chair away from the desk and took the steel-rimmed spectacles off his nose and waved with them at the armchair below the window. "Thank you, sir." While he crossed to the chair, Sean rose and went to the Stinkwood cabinet. "If it's something that's important, we'd best take a dram to steel ourselves. Like going over the top," he smiled again. "It's not yet noon," Mark pointed out. "That's a rule you taught me yourself." "The man who makes the rules is allowed to change them," said Sean, pouring two huge measures of golden brown spirit and spurting soda from the siphon. "That's a rule I've just this moment made." And he laughed, a fat, contented chuckle, before he went on. "Well, my boy, as it so happens, you have chosen a good day for it." He carried one glass to Mark and returned to his desk. "I also have dire and important business to discuss." He took a swallow from his glass, smacked his lips in evident relish, and then wiped his moustache on the back of his hand. "As the elder, it will be in order if we discuss my business first." "Of course, sir." Mark looked relieved and sipped cautiously at his glass, while Sean beamed at him with ill-concealed self-satisfaction. Sean had conceived of a scheme so devious and tailored so fittingly to his need that he was a little in awe of the divine inspiration which had fostered it. He did not want to lose this young man, and yet he knew that the surest way of doing so was trying to hold him too close. "While we were in Cape Town, I had two long discussions with the Prime Minister," he began. "And since then we have exchanged lengthy correspondence. The upshot of all this is that General Smuts has formed a separate portfolio and placed it under my ministry. It is simply the portfolio of national parks. There is still legislation to see through Parliament, of course, and we will need money and new powers, but I am going ahead right away with a survey and assessment of all proclaimed areas, and we will act on that to develop and protect..." He went on talking for almost 15 minutes, reading from the Prime Minister's letters and memoranda, explaining and expanding, going over the discussions, detailing the planning, while Mark sat forward in his chair, the glass at his side forgotten, listening with a rising sense of destiny at work, hardly daring to breathe as he drank in the great concept that was unfolded for him. Sean was excited by his own vision, and he sprang up from the desk and paced the yellow wood floor, gesturing, using hands and arms to drive home each point, then stopping suddenly in full flight and turning to stand over Mark. "General Smuts was impressed with you, that night at Boyson's and before that." He stopped again, and Mark was so engrossed that he did not see the cunning expression on Sean's face. "I had no trouble persuading him that you were the man for the job." "What job?" Mark demanded eagerly. The first area I'm concentrating on is Sharka's Gate and the Bubezi Valley. Somebody has got to go in there and do a survey, so that when we go to Parliament we know what we are talking about. Well, you know the area well. The great silences and peace of the wilderness rushed back to Mark, and he felt himself craving them like a drunkard. Of course, once the bill is through Parliament, I'll need a warden to implement the act. Mark sank slowly back in his chair. Suddenly the search was over. Like a tall ship that has made its offing, he felt himself come about and settle on true course, with the wind standing fair for a fine passage. "Now, what was it you wanted to talk to me about?" Sean asked genially.
"Nothing," said Mark softly.
"Nothing at all." And his face was shining like that of a religious convert at the moment of revelation. Mark Anders had been a stranger to happiness, true happiness, since his childhood. He was like an innocent discovering strong liquor for the first time, and he was almost entirely unequipped to deal with it. It induced in him a state of euphoria, a giddy elation that transported him to levels of human experience whose existence he had not previously guessed at. Sean Courtney had engaged a new secretary to take over Mark's duties from him. He was a prematurely bald, unsmiling little man who affected a shiny black alpaca jacket, an old-fashioned celluloid butterfly collar, a green eyeshade, and cuff protectors. He was silent, intense, and totally efficient, and nobody at Lion Cop dreamed of calling him anything but Mr. Smathers. Mark was to stay on for a further month to instruct Mr. Smathers in his new duties, and at the same time Mark was to set his own affairs in order and make the preparations for his move to Sharker's Gate. Mr. Smathers' inhuman efficiency was such that within a week Mark found himself relieved almost completely of his previous duties, and with time to gloat over his new happiness. Only now that it had been given to him did he realise how those tall stone portals of Sharker's Gate had thrown their shadows across his life, how they had become for him the central towers of his existence, and he longed to be there already, in the silence and the beauty and the peace, building something that would last for ever. He realised how the recent whirlpool of emotion and action had driven from his mind the duty he had set himself, to find the grave of old Grandfather Anders and fathom the mystery of his death. It was all now before him, and his life had purpose and direction. But this was only the foundation and base of his happiness, from which he could launch himself into the towering, heady heights of his love. True enchantment had sprung from that incredible moment in the grassy saucer on the slopes of the Ladyburg escarpment. His love, which he had borne secretly, a burden cold and heavy as a stone, had in a single magical instant burst open, flowering like a seed into a growth of such vigour and colour and beauty and excitement that he could not yet grasp it all. He and Storm cherished it so dearly that no other must even guess at its existence. They made elaborate plans and pacts, weaved marvellously involved subterfuges about themselves to protect this wondrous treasure of theirs. They neither spoke to each other nor even looked at the other in the presence of a third party, and the restraint taxed each of them so that the moment that they were alone together they fell ravenously upon each other. When they were not alone together, they spent most of their time planning and scheming how to be so. They wrote each other flaming notes which were passed under the table in the presence of Sean and Ruth, and should have seared the fingers that touched them. They developed codes and signs. They found secret places, and they took hideous chances. Danger spiced their already piquant banquet of love and delight, and they were both insatiable. At first they rode to hidden places in the forest along separate and convoluted pathways, and galloped the last mile, arriving breathless and laughing, embracing, still in the saddle, while the horses stamped and snorted. The first time they were still locked together when they tumbled from the saddles to the forest bed of dead leaves and ferns, and they left their horses loose,